It could be for sale.
So you just recently saw To Live and Die in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
That's like one of my top 10 all-time favorite movies. And I can't remember the name of the actor who stars in it. But he's in CSI or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And he's... I can't, like, outside of that Manhunter, he's like just one of those 80s faces that you just know, you know? But, like, can't put your finger on where else you've seen him.
Also, the soundtrack for To Live and Die in L.A. was provided by Wang Chung. I don't know if you know that or not.
I did. I saw that, and I was like, holy shit. I've never pegged myself for a Wang Chung dude, but I was really into the soundtrack. It was pretty cool.
That's probably the best thing they've done, because the only song that comes to mind is their hit video from the 80s that has the chorus, "Everybody Wang Chung Tonight."
That's right.
But the soundtrack for that film was pretty, it was fitting, because it just had that like 80s cocaine-fueled sort of fervor.
Yeah.
You know, which is like very spot on for that movie.
Yeah, you can kind of see the popped collars, you know?
Yeah.
And all that. I was really into it. Is there such, I mean, you know, like I said, I just saw it. I guess there's a soundtrack out for it. Could you get a soundtrack for it?
Yeah, yeah, you can find
Final?
It. Oh, yeah. I mean, all those films from the 80s soundtracks came out on LP.
Yeah, I have no idea. I obviously didn't do any research about that.
Yeah.
But
I remember seeing it around in different record stores, because I like buying soundtracks. And back a while ago, I was looking for soundtracks to, like, you know, the that movie with Neil Young, that Neil Young did the soundtrack for, by Jim Jarmusch, the
Dead Man.
I was trying to find that on vinyl, and came across the To Live and Die in L.A. soundtrack, but I didn't grab it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, you've been looking for it. You looked for it for 2 years afterward. I feel like that's my vinyl luck, you know, like my vinyl karma. I skip something, and then I end up looking for it for the next 2 years.
Have you ever heard of a movie called Christian F.?
No.
It's a German movie that I saw, like, back in the 80s, which was, like, probably right around the time I was checking out, like, To Live and Die in L.A. Completely unrelated. Like, one, I mean, well, they're both about drugs, basically. But the Christian F. movie was, it had the German actress Nadia Brunghorst in it,
mm-hmm.
who plays, like, a girl who's getting hooked on heroin and this whole dark descent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundtrack for that movie is David Bowie's soundtrack.
Oh, you know, I feel like I've seen that on vinyl around.
I own that on vinyl, because I remember buying that soundtrack. The movie had such an impact on me that I went out to the record store and I bought it. Like, it was probably like a new release, you know, in this country at least. But yeah, there's a version of Heroes on that that's only on the soundtrack. And it's Heroes / Helden. And, you know, the first half of the song is Bowie singing in English. And then the second half is he sings the song in German, you know. So it has this, like, bleak, like, Berlin, like, vibe to it. You know?
How's this German?
Probably great. I mean, that dude, you know, are you surprised that he can speak fluent German?
I guess he was in Berlin all those years. But, yeah, you know, it's just so funny. It's funny to think about that. But I'm going to have to check that out. Do you know who directed it?
I don't know. Some German guy.
Yeah.
You know.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, I've been trying to turn people onto that. And also the Cat People soundtrack, too.
Oh, great. My God. You know how I came across the Cat People soundtrack is, I think it was... It's one of those Def Jux artists. I think it was Cannibal Ox.
Okay.
And they sampled... LP did the beats. And he sampled that... Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. He sampled that for that. And I was just like, that's the craziest sample I've ever heard. This is when I was really into, like, kind of darker hip-hop stuff. And
I don't know anything about that scene. You should give me some recommendations.
Yeah, yeah. So, we're talking about Cat People and...
Yeah, Cat People and the soundtrack and Peter Murphy in the beginning, Bauhaus, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, think a little bit about
Jeff Jooks and stuff like that. But yeah, it's that's how I got onto it. And then I'll always remember the first time I saw Inglourious Basterds. And I think there's that scene where the girl is getting ready to, you know, burn that entire theater down.
Right.
She uses that one David Bowie song. What was it? I forgot the name of the song.
But I don't even remember that scene because yeah. I wasn't really a big fan of that movie.
Yeah, yeah. But I remember, like, thinking, oh, that's great. It's great that he reused that song. But anyways, yeah.
Bowie's contribution to the Lost Highway soundtrack, too, is pretty killer. That soundtrack I own, too. That's like, you know, Cruise Me or whatever I think it's called, or Cruise Me Babe or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like two, it's an intro and an outro in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I always love Bowie, even though I'm not a fan of like every one of his records. I think that like he still manages to kind of put out decent stuff that's like good and you know, interesting at least.
Yeah. I think I was probably a fan up to and including Scary Monsters. I mean, I like the glam stuff too. I mean,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I, and you know, obviously like the 80s stuff I kind of grew up with and you know, I like it, but obviously it's like, doesn't compare to the old shit, but,
I thought Let's Dance is pretty killer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was, like, you know, I was, like, growing up during the 80s, and that was something I remember seeing videos for and being like, wow, this is really cool, you know.
Yeah. But, did you know that, I think Stevie Ray Vaughan plays on that?
Yeah, he's on the record. I think he did the tour, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't think I knew that. That's funny.
That's a little bit of a head scratcher, you know what I mean?
It's total head scratcher.
Because you know, Stevie Ray is like a man of the blues, you know what
yeah,
I mean? It's
yeah.
Sort of an interesting choice of musician for him to have in his band.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think he also had Peter Frampton. Mm-hmm. I believe Paige Hamilton played guitar for Bowie in like a later in the 90s or something like that.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't think I knew that. That's funny. But yeah, you know. Yeah, that's a killer soundtrack. I mean, I think when it comes to soundtracks, I've always kind of been into, like, the classic, like, you know, Western soundtracks and stuff like that. And, you know, there's certain other things. I've never really delved that too much into it. I mean, for a while there, I was into, like, kind of... when I was, I had like this stint where I was really into like hip hop and hip hop samples and stuff. And, I was into like French soundtracks, you know, where they do like, where a lot of like different samples would come from like Wu-Tang stuff and all kinds of stuff like that. But
what films, like what French films?
French? God, I forgot the name of it. Le Planet du Sauvage is one of them.
Okay.
I remember that. There's a lot of hip-hop samples in that. And, you know, I'm kind of drawing a blank right now, but that's definitely one of the big ones. I'm sure I'll come up with it in a little bit. But
so, Fred, aside from being a, you know, mainstay Brooklyn Vegan, I don't even know, what is your involvement with Brooklyn Vegan?
Well, I do all the punk and metal stuff. I also write a lot of posts that people don't know that I'm writing. And I photo edit a little bit. It's kind of, you know, it's a small shop. There's three dudes. So it's kind of, everyone has to be hands-on with everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, obviously I have my core competencies, but, I'm kind of all over the place, you know?
So it's Brooklyn Vegan is three people basically.
Well, three core people.
And
then,
core people.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, we work with a bunch of other people. There's three people, like, there's the Brooklyn Vegan who started the site in 2005 or whatever, I think it was. There's another guy whose name is Bill, and his stuff is more kind of the Pop Gun, Glasslands style stuff, you know. Like
indie in the truest sense of the word, not in the Kings of Leon sense, if you can bear with me with that. And obviously me, who kind of does a little bit of everything else. So, but yeah, so it's the three of us, and then there's a couple people. Like, we have somebody on staff who does, like, kind of helps us with events, and then we have other people who help with, like, photo stuff, and then we have a bunch of photographers that all contribute and all that. So
is it a secret who the main Brooklyn Vegan guy is? Is he just the Brooklyn Vegan, or secret who he is?
He's this guy named Dave, and the reason he started is the same reason why I started writing as BBG, is that I was writing a lot at my day job, and I didn't want to know. I don't want people to know how much I was writing.
Right.
So that's kind of why he started doing that. And you know, anonymity has its advantages. In a lot of different senses. You know, especially when going to shows and meeting people, etc. You don't have to deal with being sold on bands and stuff, and you can kind of keep it more pure, that kind of thing. So that's kind of, I think, why he does it. That's kind of why I was doing it for so long. So I could kind of stay as close to the music, but also at arm's length, you know?
But everyone knows it's, I mean, you're not anonymous anymore.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. I'm not really anonymous anymore ever since I started doing this, full time, and it's a lot. It's a completely different thing now. So, but back then it was, you know, I had to do everything on the sneak tip. So, you know, when you got to do that, got to do what you got to do. So, anyways,
and then somewhere along the line, you started promoting shows mm-hmm. under the Brooklyn Vegan, you know, moniker.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, how did that sort of happen? Like, what was the process with that?
Well, the process was originally is I was going to a lot of shows, and I would go and I would shoot, and it got to the point where, and this is my really convoluted way of coming up with, of booking shows. Well, basically, I would go to a show Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and I'd maybe see four bands that I liked out of the eight playing or mm-hmm. something. And so it kind of became the point where I was like, you know, I'd rather just put four bands I like on a single bill, and then I could just, you know, I could, this is what I want to see, this is what I want to shoot. I don't have to go out every single night. So it was like almost like my backward way of being lazy, in a sense, you know, even though it's kind of infinitely more work. But yeah, that's kind of how it came about. So, and that was probably, I guess, I started doing shows again like 4-ish years ago, something like that.
I mean, you guys are also doing stuff at South by Southwest at this point, too. You have, like, showcases. And,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I've been doing, we're going to be going on 5 years that I've been doing showcases, but we've been doing showcases probably about 8 or 9 years at this point.
I didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah. I think the first one might be 2005 or 6, maybe 5. I don't know. Let's just say 6. So, yeah, maybe 7-8 years. So I did my first showcase in 2008, and it was Young Widows, Annihilation Time, Trash Talk, and I think that might be it. It's hard to remember.
But were they like legit South by Southwest shows, or were they just, you know, like, you know how there's
day
like
parties?
Yeah,
they were day parties. I had my first ever official South by showcase, mine, as opposed to Brooklyn Vegan, this year, and I did it with the Southern Lord, Power of the Riff guys. But yeah, it's every year I've been doing like anywhere from one to this past year I did 5 total South by shows. So this year was a little too brutal for me.
Wow.
So yeah, yeah. This year I did, well, I didn't do anything on Thursday or Wednesday. Thursday, let me see. Thursday, God, it's all blending together. I definitely did a show, a late night show on the bridge, and that was with, it was supposed to be with Sleepy Time Trio Reunion, Darkest Hour, Narrows and Regents, and the cops came by, and so we only did Narrows and Regents. It started raining anyway, so we just kind of bagged it.
Well, Narrows is what, the guys from Bots or something like that?
Yeah, it's Varellin, and it's, let me see, it's guys from Botch and guys from Unbroken. Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. It's, I mean, I don't know. I'm a sucker for the Varellin voice, you know. I think he's amazing. I'm a sucker for the Varellin family, honestly. You know?
Yeah, they're nice guys.
Yeah, so, but yeah, so I did that. And then I did 2 shows back to back on Friday. The day show was with Trash Talk, Off, High on Fire. God, there was 10 bands in total. Code Orange Kids, Def Heaven, Black Cobra, Dead in the Dirt, Heartless, and a few others. And then the nighttime show, which was in the same venue, was Narrows, All Pigs Must Die, Young and in the Way, Enabler, and Black Breath headlined that. It was their only show down there. But yeah, so basically I was at the venue from like 10 p.m. to like 2 a.m.
What venue was that?
Scoot Inn.
I don't know where that is.
It's in East Austin. It's pretty close to downtown. It's like, I want to say like 4th Street, like right across 35.
Okay.
But, so it's pretty close to downtown, but it's a great outdoor venue. It's probably one of my favorite outdoor venues there. It's a good spot. 2 stages we did.
Wow. So,
yeah. Fun. Oh, Ringworm was on that too. I don't know how I forgot Ringworm. But,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty stacked bill.
Yeah. Yeah.
The, Austin during South by Southwest is like total mayhem. It feels like every year it just gets more and more like intense, you know, the amount of people that are going and the number of bands that are playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this year was, I've been many years in a row, and this year was probably, I remember seeing this when I was walking down Red River. I thought to myself, oh my God, we've finally gone overboard. I was walking down Red River and I saw this gigantic black monolithic, structure, you know, it looked like a big black building, but it said Doritos across the top of it. And as I got closer, I kind of realized that it was basically a mock vending machine, right? With these bags of Doritos and, you know, that kind of coil that spits them out, you know, when you put the money in. So imagine like the Doritos and then the bottom, like 2 rows was a stage. So it was just like a bunch of bands performing in a Dorito vending thing. And I was like, that's the most singularly obnoxious thing I've ever seen.
Did Doritos sponsor that? Was that they like threw some money down and just to get that advertising out there?
Yeah.
So people can enjoy the nutritionally vacant product that is known as Doritos that probably like erodes away your life force as you eat each chip.
Do you, you're not a fan of the cheese dust?
No, I don't want to eat that kind of stuff, man.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was, and the thing must have been like 10 stories tall. It was ridiculous.
Don't get me wrong, I like chips.
Yeah.
But That's a product, man. That's not even food. That's,
yeah,
that's
no, like, I know. I'm just messing with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. That's, it was so surreal. Because obviously product placement is going to be present down there.
Oh, yeah.
But
absolutely.
That was just so over the top to me, you know. I just never seen anything like that. It was insane.
Yeah, product placement in music, man, especially nowadays that, you know, record sales and things like that are decreasing, mm-hmm. it seems, with each year.
Yeah.
Now that I think a lot of corporations see that as an opportunity to get the word out about their products by mm-hmm. sponsoring different events and bands and tours and records and whatnot. You know, of course, Scion being like, mm-hmm. you know, one of the biggest innovators of that style of marketing, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, I've taken money from Scion to do things, believe mm-hmm. me, you know. It's, but, yeah, I don't know how comfortable I am really with all that stuff these days. But, you know, I mean, it's hard to justify doing that sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a completely different ballgame than it used to be, you know? Like, no one... I don't know. It's just a strange thing. It's kind of like... It's almost like you can't... It's almost like the only way to make money in a musical sense is to have your song on an iTunes commercial or... You know, something along that line, as opposed to selling records nowadays, you know. And it's kind of sad, but it's kind of a sad reality. So anywhere that people can get money for it, I'm all for it. I mean, I think that people can be smart about it, you know, obviously not walking out in a full Nike jumpsuit and you know what I'm saying? And, you know, we're sponsored by Nike or something like that. I think there's a way to be, to ride that and, you know, take money from people who want to invest in you, but also not kind of sell your soul too. I think the best bands know how to do that. You know, I think you can do that and not be, I think it also depends on the style of band you have. I mean, you know, certain bands, the ethos behind them just doesn't match. But then, you know, they might take money anyway. You know, there are definitely bands like that. So
what do you mean? Like,
well, there are certain bands that, you know, like, I'm trying to think of a band that, like, you know, like maybe like a band like a grindcore band, you know, like a band that's kind of a anti-capitalist band or anti, you know, a very political band, you know, that kind of thing to me is completely incongruous with like, taking money from a corporation. You know, it's kind of, it doesn't make sense. Your band is one concept and you're taking money about, you know, by sacrificing your own kind of, goals as a band and your own, principles. What it amounts to is being a principled person, you know. So,
speaking of principles, the irony of that is that most of the kids that are involved as, you know, fans of grindcore mm-hmm. are probably the ones who are the biggest perpetrators of downloading music and complaining about shows being too expensive and
yeah.
that sort of thing.
Yeah,
you know, it's just, you know, people's thing with that is, oh yeah, you know, I don't have any money, but it's like gas is almost $5 a gallon. And if you're trying to, you know, travel across the country with that sort of expense every day, that's then you really understand what it means to not have any money.
Right.
You know, it's like if you, you know, you're working your job and, you know, you've got your apartment you're sharing with three people or whatever.
Right.
You know, and like maybe like if you want to support a band, if you want to like, you know, be part of that scene, you should think about prioritizing where you spend your money.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, maybe like quit smoking or something like that.
Right.
You know,
right. Right.
You know, maybe then you can afford to buy a t-shirt and a band, and a record when your favorite band comes to town.
Absolutely.
Instead of complaining about things being, I don't have any money, man. Meanwhile, you just bought a, you know, a half rack of like Bud Lights or whatever, you know. Yeah. That's the thing that used to blow my mind. Because, I mean, when I went out with Warm Rot, you know, that tour went really well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those were the kids who basically would download all the records and, you know, complain about how they don't have any money. But half of those kids all had, like, fresh sneakers on and, like,
yeah,
you know, were buying 40-ouncers and all this other stuff.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly right, too. I mean, when that record leaked, I remember when that record leaked, and I was thinking to myself, man, you know, if people were really principled, they'd buy that record, too, yeah, you know?
Sure. Like,
especially the themes that they're talking about and the ideas that they're talking about. I mean, I don't know. I totally agree with you. And there's a fine line between making pissed off music and being pissed off about something and having principles and values and like kind of talking about that, you know? And I think that's what grindcore should be. That's my opinion on what grindcore is. But it's just a strain of like of political punk rock. So
in this climate of you know, declining record sales,
yeah,
you decided to start a label.
Because I'm dumb. Well, here's the deal: is when I decided to start a label, it was number one. Here's the thing. I know it's really easy to be cynical. Oh, this guy works at a blog. He's starting his own label. It's corporate synergy and all that kind of bullshit.
Corporate synergy?
Yeah.
What the hell is that even? What do you mean? Like,
you know what I'm saying? Like, he starts a blog. He talks about new bands. Oh, and he just happens to have something to sell you.
But what's wrong with that, though?
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying. What I'm saying about that is I'm trying to, as a journalist, separate things, you know. And so I tried to talk about that band. I did like them, and if I was to really show how much I liked them, I probably wrote about them a lot more. And I'd probably put their record up for free download, and I'd probably, you know, talk about them a lot more than I did. But what I tried to do instead was take it back to when I was buying records, you know. When I would buy records, there would be many times when I would buy a record based on a band's logo, based on if this other cool band I know would, like, shout them out in the liner notes, you know, if it's, like, a killer label, if it's great art, maybe even song titles. You know, maybe this dude was in this other band with this other dude, and that's why I was into it. So that's kind of what I was trying to bring back, you know. We did this, no digital, just vinyl. And, you know, we had some offers from good hardcore labels to put it out in a digital format and put it out on CD, but I just wanted to do vinyl. I wanted to do it old school because that's just what I love is vinyl, you know. So
I know that you have the Psychic Limb release.
Yeah.
But what other stuff do you have?
Well, I'm working on a few things right now, but I'm trying to be as picky as I can. I think what a lot of labels do, especially small startup labels, is they want to get their name out there as soon as they can, so they have like maybe four or five releases on deck. I want to seriously love every single record I do. So I've got a couple things that I'm working on, but, you know, I'm trying to take my time and just put out things that I really care about, and that's it. So, yeah, that's really it.
That's probably the best way of doing things these days, because most likely you're looking at a longer period of time before you get any kind of return on the money you lay down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, you're going to probably, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. What do I know about putting out records? But like, you know, there's probably a little bit of a lag between that initial investment and then, like, you know, you have to operate in the red for a little bit while longer these days until you can afford to like put out something else or, you know, repress the record or that kind of thing.
Yeah. Getting back to what we were just talking about, it's hard to operate in the black at all, you know,
yeah.
in this economy. So, I mean, that's the other thing is I don't want to, I'm not going to put my money out there if I like a record or if I kind of like a record, you know, I want to love the record. And I want to believe in it with everything that I have. And otherwise, I'm wasting my time, I'm wasting my money, and I'm wasting other people's time, you know? And so that's the reason why I'm here right now, as far as, like, I haven't put out a second release. But, yeah.
That's all good, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the whole paradigm of, you know, music and records and all this other stuff is shifting over these last few years. And, you know, the way that music is consumed by people, you know, it's like become less, it's almost like there's like this disposable vibe to it where it's just like another file that you can like store on your computer next to like photographs of your girlfriend's pussy or something like that. You know?
It's like, right.
You know, it's like I got all these like naked photographs. Oh yeah. Here's my record collection. Here's my music collection, a collection of MP3 files. You know, so I mean, it's good that there's still people like yourself who are like want to make it more than that.
Yeah,
you know, you want it to be like a something special that you actually have to physically hold in your hand to enjoy.
Yeah, and you know, not to sound like and here's the deal: is when I wanted a record, I would either buy it or I'd go to my buddy's place and I'd dub it. You know.
Yeah.
Nowadays. Or he'd dub it for me, or whatever. You know what I'm saying. Nowadays, I can go, like, Mike, I could go to your house, for instance, bring a portable hard drive, mm-hmm. and take every single file you own in, like, an hour.
Yeah, of course.
You know? Mm-hmm. And that's the thing is, no human being can go through that much music. And I can understand, like, being able to kind of drift along the top and kind of see what's going on and maybe get an idea for everything. But there's been so many records, I'm sure you can attest to this, where you've maybe hated it the first time you've gone through, and then at maybe the second or third time, you've really loved it, and that's the most, those are the records that stay with you the longest, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
You know?
Yeah, I guess I can see that.
Yeah.
I mean, I download records, but it's more like I want to check something out that I haven't heard before.
Yeah.
That someone is like, oh, you need to listen to this.
Sure.
And then if I'm 9 out of 10 times I buy it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've also paid for downloads through iTunes, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And it's like, because I don't, you know, if I don't like the record, I'll like delete it. Because I mean, like, why do I need this?
Right.
You know? And
right.
It's like, in that case, I guess, you know, I tried it out, wasn't into it. But I like vinyl, you know what I mean? I like to have something, I like to have a physical copy with, like, cool artwork and, you know, liner notes and the lyrics printed on something, you know, like that. It's like that Watain record is, like, an awesome package, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's got, like, that killer poster. And,
yeah.
You know, I like to think that somebody actually
put like, the some, super diehard one, you have that?
Yeah, that's the one I got.
Cool.
You know, and it's like, I like to think that someone put some effort into it, you know, and I think that's really what I appreciate is, like, effort. You know, and care and sort of passion instead of like, oh, I'm going to throw this together, record it in Logic, and yeah, I made an MP3, and here you go, take it
yeah.
for free. Take my like hours of my life that I put into something and just take it for free, and you can like forget about it, you know?
Right.
That I'm not into.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think one thing that's important to counter your point is if you're a young band, I think it's a great idea. You can use this cheap way of like recording music and getting it out there. I think that's one of the best things about the current climate is you can get your music out there easily and cheaply. And, you know, maybe eventually, you know, you can charge for it. Like, but I think it's a great thing if you're a young band, put together a demo and maybe make it available to people for free. Because that's the hardest thing nowadays is to get seen in this climate, you know? Because everybody's got a band.
Yep.
And
people that shouldn't have bands too.
Exactly. And so, like, getting seen nowadays is easier, but at the same time, harder to. It's easier to get your stuff out there. It's harder to get truly, truly noticed, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, that hasn't really changed, because even back, like, you know, prior to this free and easy world of downloading,
yeah,
you know, bands would still make demos on cassettes or CDRs. You know, and I was part of that, you know, back in the 90s, demos I made.
Sure.
We, you know, you gave them out to people, you sent them to dudes at other labels that you might want to, you know, hopefully they listen to it or whatever. Other bands, you gave them your demo. I don't recall ever really selling a demo. Yeah. I mean, maybe the first Anodyne demo we sold on some dates we had, but...
Well, I think what I'm talking about is not necessarily you giving it to labels or giving it to friends. I'm talking about this fourth or fifth removed person that you don't know that lives in middle of nowhere, Iowa, who has no connection to you whatsoever, coming at your demo. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm talking about. Kind of stumbling upon something, you know. And I think that's the difference between what we're talking about. You know, obviously in the 80s, you know, there was the whole kind of people would get noticed with, like, demo trading with, like, tapes and stuff like that. Or, you know, you might give your demo to certain important people. But what I'm talking about is, like, the regular Joe who doesn't know a soul who plays a band or a soul who books a band or anything like that getting noticed, you know. That's kind of my point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the one thing that definitely separates people, though, is, like, whether they're willing to go on the road or not, too, is the other thing. You know?
Yes.
So, like, that's, you can make a recording and get it out there at Bandcamp or whatever, but if you really want to do it and take the music to the people, I guess that's what really separates people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's a shame because, you know, there are a lot of great bands out there that... And there are a lot of great bands out there that I've seen live that just don't really tour. And I think if they did, they'd probably be gigantic and do much better than they're doing, you know. But yeah, I agree with you.
Speaking of big shows, tonight there's a big show here in New York City, which I think everyone that I probably know is going to. It's the Behemoth Watain Devil's Blood in Solitude.
Mm-hmm.
With Evoking, I guess, is opening the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you going to that?
Yeah, I'm going. I've got such a problem today because I really want to see Boston Strangler, and Boston Strangler's playing.
Who the hell is this? Who are they?
Boston Strangler? It's this hardcore band from Boston. It's like members of, like, they're like real, like, SSD style hardcore.
But they're like 22 years old, probably.
Yeah, no, they're like mid-20s, and like, the guys are in, like, I'm very particular about hardcore now, like, but they're in all these bands that I like Mind Eraser, Rival Mob, bands like that. Let me see, there's just a bunch of bands that they're in and that I'm really into. They even have a doom band called Magic Circle, and so yeah, they're playing. That's kind of a rare thing, and they're playing with a couple hardcore bands, and they're opening for Tragedy. So I mean, I love Tragedy, and nothing against them at all, because I think they're the best. I actually saw them 3 times last year, so I'll probably skip them. But I'm trying to figure out a way to work out both today. I'm definitely going to be at both. It's just a question of what I'm going to do. I'm having this internal struggle right now. So,
wow, that's a pretty tough show. Well, actually, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think, like, that show, like, hardcore fans, I don't know if are necessarily going to go see Behemoth and Watain.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. I think Watain, if anything. But, yeah, I know a lot of, like, punk guys who are, you know, the black metal that they do like is that kind of raw and, like, kind of a little crusty, evil shit, you know. And I think Watain definitely kind of fills that void for them, or definitely is one of those bands that they care for, you know. So I'm going to go to both. I don't know what I'm going to do. So,
out of the bands that are playing the Behemoth show, like what are the ones that you're like most interested in seeing? I mean, you've probably seen Matane a number of times.
Yeah, I've seen Matane a number of times. I'm curious about Behemoth now that he's free of cancer. I've heard that he's just absolutely electric now, just like really, really kind of in the moment and is loving every moment of it. And I'm interested in seeing them, even though like, I like Behemoth. I'm not the hugest fan of them, but, I'm interested in seeing that just because I know the history behind it and all that kind of stuff. I think the band that I'm most excited to see is probably Devil's Blood. I saw Devil's Blood with Pentagram at Webster Hall. I want to say 3 years ago. I don't remember. Maybe 2 years ago. I don't remember. It was, but yeah. So that should be fun. Avoken, I like Avoken. And nothing against them, but yeah, I'm sure I'll have my chances to see them because they're from New Jersey.
Yeah.
So, and Wu-Tang, I'm not fooling anyone by saying that they're the best. But one thing that I am curious about is, it's a Live Nation venue. I would imagine that they probably can't roll out the red carpet for all of their entire, stage show with like the rotting corpses and the whole night.
The rotting corpses.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so it'll be a little bit different from when I last saw them in New York at Santos, which was, it was pretty foul, but it was amazing.
Yeah, I was on tour when that came through. I remember it was, that was a Black Gamble, I think.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
Goat Whore.
Yeah,
I wanted to see that, and I missed that.
Yeah, it was that was the most foul stench I've ever smelled. It was unbelievable, and I shot that show, and there's no barrier there, so and I have no problem with that. But I'll tell you what, that day I had a problem with it. Yeah, it was just when they say it smelled like death, I had no idea what that really meant, but I smelled it, and it was, the best way I can describe it is, like, concentrated zoo smell, like, the foulest stench ever, and the guys come out, and they're great live performers. They rage on stage, but they've also covered themselves in blood, mm-hmm. So there's, like, little flecks of blood on my clothes from that show, and yeah, I was cleaning my camera for weeks. But yeah, it was fucking awesome.
Yeah, definitely. That's the one thing I do like about Wu-Tang is that, they kind of walk the walk, because all these, black metal bands are, satanic and evil and whatever. And I think that they're one of the few bands that sort of, as much as a band / entertainer can do,
mm-hmm.
that really goes that, into that realm of presenting something that's akin to what their, purported beliefs are.
Yeah.
If you want to see darkness, this is probably something that's close to a simulation of darkness,
And the great thing is about that, if I can kind of step away a little bit, is that, Wu-Tang is they're getting up there. They're becoming a big band, obviously when they played Santos, they sold out Santos. It's like 450, 500, something like that. With the right promotion, I bet they could do much more than that. But my point is that as this band grows, it's not like they're watering down year by year. It's almost like they're kind of getting a little bit more negative and kind of going further down the rabbit hole, if you will, which is badass and whatever. Anyways.
Yeah, it's interesting, their philosophies and whatnot, but, mm-hmm. There's an irony about being successful and becoming more and more evil, I guess, mm-hmm. to me, you mm-hmm. know, but that's just me.
Yeah.
You know? And,
well, I think if that's part of your persona, you know, the evil, we are an evil band, you know,
right.
You know, I think the bigger you get, the harder it is for people to believe it.
Yeah.
And, they kind of kept an even keel in my head. But anyways.
Yeah, it should be a good show, though. I'm going to be there pretty much for everyone. You know, I'd like to see Devil's Blood. And, you know, it'd be good to see Watain again. But I'm probably most excited about seeing Behemoth just for that reason alone, that Nurgle overcame cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
pretty, I think immediately after he was cool with his on his health, you know, situation, they did a bunch of dates in Europe just mm-hmm. to be like, and I think the name of that tour was like, you know, Phoenix Rising Tour or something, like just some killer.
That's badass.
Or, you know, this kind of just badass, you know, overcoming adversity like vibe. And here right. they are doing like a full on, you know, extensive US tour.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm really excited. And I think Behemoth's an amazing band too. And I love their music. So,
so
it should be a real, and I've been waiting to see them play because I was, even if they had done, originally they were slated to headline the tour with Watain and Goad War.
Mm-hmm.
But that was when his health, I guess, issues arose.
Yeah, and, it was like 2 years ago or something? Like,
yeah, about that. Yeah. And I wouldn't even have been able to see them on that tour. So I've been waiting a long time to see them play.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it'll be great. But, you know, it's such a great, I hate to kind of rub it in for, like, people who are listening who don't live in New York, but, you know, it's such a great problem to have. It's like, oh, I don't know if I can see Tragedy because I might miss what
they... Yeah. Wait, Tragedy's playing tonight?
Yeah, today. Yeah.
Oh, it's like it was a day show? Or
yeah, well, it starts at 6, and it's 4 bands.
Oh.
So it's Sickoids, Perdition, who's a great Brooklyn punk band, and Boston Strangler, and Tragedy. And so that show has to be out. It's at Le Poisson Rouge, which is becomes a dance party area. So I'm sure that's going to be over early.
Hmm.
So I'll definitely be able to catch Behemoth, and I'll work it out so I'll be able to catch Watain too. And I'm going to try to work out as much as I can.
Behemoth goes on at 10 tonight.
They do?
Yeah, because my friend Thorns is on tour with. He's working on that tour.
Okay.
And he sent me the sheet, so...
Okay.
Yeah, so just be advised, man.
Yeah, well, I will be there for that. I'm not going to miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, anyways, it's a good problem that we have.
Rorschach is playing at Le Poisson Rouge as well.
Yeah.
Later this month.
Yeah.
Are you going to that?
I'm not, and the only reason why is because I'm going to be working at MDF... Maryland Death Fest. But if I wasn't, well, Rorschach's at that too, so I'll see them there.
Yeah.
But if I wasn't, you know, there's no fucking way I missed that. But, and you know, I want to bring up a really important point about that band, because there's so many reunited hardcore bands, and when they played in 2009, I think. It was great. It was awesome. And it was totally, like, it didn't feel like a bunch of guys who hadn't played in a while coming back together. It felt like a cohesive whole. And not only that, the crowd energy was ill. It was just great. So I'm sure that's going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, I missed him on that because I was on tour.
Yeah.
And so this will be my first... experience of them as a reunited band, you know, or a reunion or whatever we want to define this period as.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I saw them when they were around in the early 90s, and Rorschach's always been, like, one of my favorite bands, like, bar none. They're up there with, like, Black Flag and Neurosis and the Swans mm-hmm. and those types of bands.
Mm-hmm. So. I'd love to hear your analysis post-show, because I never got to see them.
Everyone, I mean, good friends of mine that have... seen them that were close to them, like Will Tarrant from, you know, used to do Chainsaw Safety.
Yeah,
he's a really good friend of mine.
Yeah.
He he used to roadie for Rorschach on, mm-hmm. on their tours. He went to Europe with him, and he told me, he was like, yeah, it was, like, amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that was cool is that week of dates they did, it was all original members and all original crew. So it was, like...
Really?
Everyone that roadied for them and everyone that, you know, guys who, you know, hung out on the road with them.
Yeah.
It was that same group of guys doing the dates, those weeks of shows. Because I guess they did Philly and Baltimore, yeah. and I think there was a Richmond. You know, I don't even know what the dates were, but I know there was a pretty solid week of shows they played.
Yeah. Do you know if Ted Leo was part of that? He was at every show, and he actually sang My War when they covered My War.
Cool. Yeah. Well, Ted was in Citizens Arrest. He's like a... You know, I like all of Ted Leo's material, you know, and it's cooler to me that he's this indie rocker, but he also has, you know, roots in, like, what I consider to be hardcore. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not a big New York hardcore fan myself, mm-hmm. personally. Like, I mean, I like the Cro-Mags and the Agnostic Front, you know, early, but I don't necessarily call myself a New York hardcore fan. However, I do... feel really tightly connected to bands like Rorschach and Born Against and mm-hmm. you know, Citizens Arrest and that scene. Because mm-hmm. that was more of what I related to. I never really related to Madball or, you know, Sheer Terror, even though, like, some of those bands are great bands and they're, you know, they're really good at what they do, but it's just not my thing.
Yeah.
So that's why, like, Rorschach coming through in the midst of all these, like, Gorilla Biscuits reunions and Youth of Today reunions and Sheer Terror reunions. Mm-hmm. is extra meaningful to me because it's, like, you know, something that I can relate to.
Right.
That's actually being put forth in this day and age.
So you never really liked any of those revelation bands, like Judge?
Kiss Goodbye.
Kiss Goodbye, yeah.
Not really. I mean, I like Sick of It All. Sick of It All transcends being a hardcore band. I mean, they're one of the bands from the old days that I thought were great. And they've maintain their integrity as a band because they haven't really had any major lineup changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Craig Sitari joining the band was, like, you know, one lineup change that happened in, like, 1992 or something.
Right.
He's definitely overcome the new guy syndrome. He's been in the band for over 20 years.
Yeah, a little bit.
That's something I really, it's hard to keep a lineup together, you know, and especially in a band like that's touring constantly and, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I always give Sick of It All props, full props, because, you know, not only were they touring Europe, which is, like, a big thing that New York hardcore bands do, they don't really tour the States, but they'll go to Europe, because that style of hardcore is embraced over there.
Mm-hmm.
But Sick of It All toured the States extensively. They went all over. They did their thing, and they were always, they earned everything they have.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to, it seemed like in the 90s at some point, if you were a band from New York, you'd just go to Europe and tour, you know.
Right.
But, you know, it was easier to do that for a while. But now it's, like, you know, a little harder because there's so many bands going there now.
Right.
But yeah, Sick of It All has always been. So they're, like, the revelation band I dug. I mean, don't get me wrong. I liked Youth of Today a little bit in the day because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I checked out those bands. But they were never something that I really related to.
Yeah.
Because it was, in some ways, more about conformity than individuality.
Yeah, I agree with you. But you know what? I agree with you in retrospect, you know? Like, when I was, like, 12, 13, 14 years old, you know? And even though you're right, it is a different form of conformity. When I was going to my high school, or my middle school or whatever, and, you know, these records by Youth of Today came out, who were talking about all these different issues that were completely alien to what was going on in the radio. It felt like the opposite of conformity, you know, it felt like doing something different. But yeah, that's kind of what I grew up on. It's like that kind of youth crew shit like that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's definitely got its time and place. It's not something I could really relate to. You know, I think because I'm a few years older than you, you know, I hit Black Flag before that. Like, I hit
mm-hmm.
Minor Threat. You know, I got into Husker Du, and I got into bands like that, which were way more meaningful to me than like, you know, Gorilla Biscuits or Youth of Today. Yeah. Nothing against any of those bands. Yeah. Nothing against Rick Capo. Everyone has their own, you know, trip, and I, you know, they're relevant. And I, to an extent, I support, you know, the straight edge ideas to some extent, you know, especially as a young man growing up in a world like, you know, where there's a lot of distractions being presented in your path, you know, it's important to keep, you know, keep yourself away from things that could ultimately lead you down a path that might prohibit you from accomplishing your goals.
Absolutely.
But I just couldn't relate to it because it was very, you know, there was like this jock vibe to it, you know what I mean? And that was something I wasn't into.
And I feel like that jock vibe has gotten more and more pronounced as the years have gone on. You know, it's become, you know, it's become like this kind of go and fuck somebody up in the pit thing, as opposed to go and, to me about the whole thing about moshing was going out there and like kind of getting your frustrations down, not about like going out there and I want to fuck this guy up, you know, that's not what I took away from
that. Yeah, of course.
You know, but that's kind of the mentality in a lot of kids had, which I think is ridiculous. But I want to bring back an important point, because what you said hit the nail on the head, in that you came to you know, some of that youth crew stuff after Black Flag, and that's exactly right. I came to the youth crew stuff first, and then I went to Black Flag, and it wasn't until much later that I got into like Husker Du and some of the different SST elements, as opposed to something a little bit more straight ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that was always what I more gravitated to, because it just seemed like those bands on SST and, like, you know, the early Discord bands and whatnot were dealing with, like, individuality and sort of being more on the outside of things.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that, like, early youth crew and early New York hardcore wasn't on the outside, because it definitely was on the outside of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something that, personally, I couldn't relate to. Yeah. I'm from the suburbs. I'm not from the streets. I'm not from New York City. It's a different experience. I didn't grow up in Brooklyn or Queens or Manhattan or the Bronx or Staten Island. I grew up in the suburbs. So my reality wasn't like surviving on the streets. So that's, to me, it seemed alien. Like, it was interesting to me, but it wasn't something ultimately that I could relate to.
Yeah.
I mean, that first Cro-Mags record I related to, to me, coming out of listening to Black Sabbath and whatnot, it was like the heaviest thing I'd ever heard, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the same thing with like Agnostic Front. Like, their first two albums sounded like, you know, super beyond metal to me, man. It was like brutal, raw, you know, evil sounding stuff, and that's what I related to, but not necessarily the stories they were telling, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And that's, yeah, it's all about your individual path, like where you started out, but yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I thought that was a great point you brought up, but because that's definitely how I came to it, is the ass backwards way.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, I grew up outside of DC, so
I never knew where you were from. So you're from outside of DC.
Yeah, outside of DC. So I like, when I was coming up, like, I was into bands like Damnation and Battery.
Oh yeah, Damnation's magnificent.
Yeah,
one
yeah.
of great bands, you know.
Those were the bands, and like This band, I think they were from Richmond, Four Walls Falling. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Those were the bands that kind of, that I was into. And eventually that led me to listening to Fugazi, which was a gateway to Jawbox and Shudder to Think and, you know, eventually Lungfish and, you know, stuff like that. And that's kind of the path of my expansion.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
I lived in Boston for a few years in the 90s, so I know all about, like, violence and,
yeah,
you know, that's town. Like, people say New York's a tough town, and it is in some ways to a point. But I feel like Boston is definitely a town where you have a higher likelihood of randomly meeting some sort of violent act
mm-hmm.
than you do in New York. Like, it feels like Boston, like, on a Saturday night, anywhere in the city, you're fair game to, like, get beat up by somebody.
Right.
You know, and I've experienced it, not personally, but I've observed many, you know, Red Sox games letting out, you know, things like that. Yeah. Things that aren't even related to music, you know, let alone the violence I've seen inside at hardcore shows.
Right.
But the vibe of the city of Boston is like this angry, miserable, you know, sort of like negative trip that a lot of people seem to be on. And maybe, you know, it's just like that kind of puritanical repression, I think, that people feel in that city, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, that was definitely, I've seen probably more violence in Boston than I've ever seen in New York City as far as, like, shows go.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems, as I get older, that thing, maybe I'm just more desensitized, but it seems like as I get older, like, things are getting a little bit tamer. Like, people are roughing people up, and it's not, I mean, I remember people losing teeth and getting super fucked up at some of those shows when I was younger, but, you know, I don't know, maybe it was just more shocking to me back then. I have no idea.
Yeah, but I mean, people not getting beat up at a show, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean,
I agree. I think that, like, if you go to see a band play, you know, you shouldn't, you know, what's the takeaway from getting beat up at a show means that you're, like, you have a negative experience associated with that style of music.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it just leads to, like, more commentary on that, you know?
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, wow, I'm glad I got my ass kicked at this show.
Yeah.
You know, no one really benefits from it.
Yeah.
You know, even the guy beating you up probably at some point in that evening is like, why did I have to, like, you know, confront that guy?
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't threatening me, so.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's clearly of no benefit to anyone. But, yeah, I was just commenting on just, like, remembering some of my first hardcore shows and just, like, being shocked at, like, kind of how people were going off and going crazy and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, like, being, like, 13, 14.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. Oddly enough, like, my first, like, punk show was the Ramones. When I saw the Ramones when I was in high school, and they played. I've seen the Ramones probably about 20 times in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they were, you know, they're like Led Zeppelin to me, man. They're like one of the, you know, influential
bands.
I mean, they're, you can't not like the Ramones. You can't not like Black Sabbath. You can't, you know, not like Slayer. Well, I mean, maybe some people do.
Yeah, like, yeah.
But Slayer, Ramones, Black Sabbath, those are bands that just, like, transcend genres of music, I feel.
Yeah.
You know, the Misfits, you know, bands,
yeah,
like that. But it was the Agora Ballroom in Hartford, Connecticut. And it was the first time I'd seen, like, a punk show.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, like, 14, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So some friends drove out. We went to the show. It was also the first time I heard that band Blitz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, some, you know, group of people were cranking the Blitz record, like, in the,
yeah,
car.
Cool.
In the parking lot. So we went in, and, you know, the Queers played.
Well, yeah.
I don't even know if it was the same Queers, but there's a band called the Queers that opened the show.
Wow.
Because, you know,
yeah,
who knows? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, they sounded similar,
right,
to what I imagined the Queers to sound,
yeah,
like, or what I remember them sounding like. And the Ramones came out, and it was like a melee.
Yeah.
It was, but it wasn't like, it was just like this, you know, people skanking and like a pit and, you know, but I was just like basically like smushed up against the front of the stage.
Yeah.
And when I was done, like, everything was drenched in sweat. Like,
yeah,
I'd sweat through my jeans, my shirt was ripped, you know, my socks were wet. Everything was totally like sweated through.
Yeah.
And that was like awesome. I was like, wow, this is like a real experience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But, you know, that's different than, like, I remember seeing Earth Crisis play in Boston at the Middle East Downstairs, and it was just, like, this, like, beatdown of, like,
yeah,
way bigger guys demolishing young kids.
Yeah.
And to me, that was, like, pathetic and weak, I thought.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I always remember my first, well, I went to a bunch of shows, like, when I was little, but I won't count those because I would go with my dad to see Rush or something like that, you know,
yeah,
which was cool. I won't count those, but I would say the first show I kind of went to on my own was at the 930 Club, the old 930
Club. The old
club.
One, yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever go to the old?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Man, you know, I'm like, I was a kid and there was just that, I guess a lot of people don't really experience this now because of, like, anti-smoking laws and stuff, but there's, like, this foul stench of cigarette smoke from, like 10 years just baking in that place. You walked in there, and it was unmistakable, you know? And so you'd walk in there, you'd wait in this line that went all the way down the hall, and I remember going there, and I went with my friend and my friend's sister, I think, and we saw Clutch when they were, before they were like kind of a groovy band.
Yeah, they started out like almost like sounding similar to hardcore music.
Yeah. And I remember when they came on, this made such an impression to me. When they came on, Neil came out and he had a Bible and he was pretending like he was singing from the Bible, singing lyrics and just like ripping out pages, you know? I'm like this little kid seeing this guy like rip out pages from the Bible. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
That's old,
you know, it was just amazing. But yeah, that made such an impression on me at that point. But
I've only seen Clutch later in their, you know, like later on when they're like this sort of almost like, you know,
groove,
like a groovy, like almost Star. Like a Grateful Dead, like
yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is fine because I actually like the Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm. And I saw the Grateful Dead back when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, I'm not using that as like a diss or anything like that because I think the Grateful Dead are cool. But that's the only time I'd ever seen Clutch play. I never saw them as the more aggressive version of themselves.
Yeah.
They toured with Slayer, I remember. I forgot what, maybe it had them in the late 90s, like maybe 99, and there was a tour that was Slayer, Clutch, and possibly System of a Down.
What?
Yeah, wow. Maybe. I'm pretty sure it was System of a Down. And I went to that show, you know, just, I got there when Clutch was playing,
mm-hmm.
and that was like the beginning of their groovy, like, era, mm-hmm. you know, and that's, so I'd never even seen Clutch as like a hard-ass, you know, band, really.
Yeah, that... I remember that EP because I wasn't really super familiar with them when I went. It was just kind of like, let's go see this band, you know? But it was I think it's called the Passive Restraints EP. And it came out, I think it came out on Earache. It was like a 3-song EP. And I remember going there and then I think I bought my first record there too. Like, first, when I say first record, first one that I purchased that my parents had nothing to do with, you know, and it was the Clutch Pitchfork 12-inch. And that was also a semi-hardcore style record, too. There was definitely, like, there was a bluesy, like, Sabbath-y undercurrent, but it was definitely rooted in punk rock, you know?
Yeah. What were, like, some of the records that you listened to when you were a kid? Like, that, you know... Like you said, you went to see Rush with your dad, which is badass. Because I love Rush and all the you know, early rock bands like that. So like the changeover from like, you know, maybe like your childhood, you know, influence of your parents into what put you on the path that you're on today. Like, what was like the first couple of records that you picked up that put you down that road?
Wow. It's a tough question. I have to think about that.
You just said one of them was a Clutch.
Yeah. That Clutch record. Yeah, but I have to think about what else. Well, I will say that the first record I ever remember listening to and asking my dad to play was Another Brick in the Wall by Pink Floyd. Because I remember, and this is a really specific memory, being a little kid... And remembering, you know, there's the kids on the chorus. We mm-hmm. don't need. I remember I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, a little and, scary, too.
Yeah. And I also remember my mom being very upset.
Yeah.
And walking around the house screaming, we don't need no education, man. You know.
Make people uncomfortable, definitely.
Absolutely. That was definitely one of those records that made a big impression on me. And I'd say... It's funny, I don't even know what record this is, to be honest with you. But my dad had this Black Sabbath Greatest Hits on tape. And Soldier Sold a Rock and Roll. It had like a different cover. It was like this cover of The Apocalypse, like a famous painting. I don't know what the deal was. I don't know if he got it. I don't know if it was one of those, like, truck stop deals, you know?
Could be.
Yeah. But it was, like... it was, like, the old school cover. You remember the old school cover, tape covers, where it was, like, black bar at the bottom, black bar at the top? Yeah, and I remember my dad played, you know, we'd be driving around and he played Iron Man. And I listened to that and I thought that was the illest song.
Yeah.
And I remember I asked my dad if I could take that tape. And I listened to that a lot. I was way into that record. Yeah. And I don't know. You know, I think some of my early, you know, I'm sure I have some of the same hallmarks as a lot of people as far as some of the early records, like probably Michael Jackson Thriller, and, you know, like my dad's in his 60s now, but mm-hmm. he's always kept up with current music.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, even now, like, you know, I'll tell him, oh, well, Dad, Coldplay has a new record, you know. Even though I'm not necessarily into him, my dad, I know my dad is into him. I put him onto, like, he's a big Neil Young guy.
Yeah,
so it's like,
Neil Young's amazing. So.
Yeah, I was like, well, Dad, you're probably like that band My Morning Jacket. So he listens to them now, which, you know, I'm not necessarily into those bands, but I think it's awesome that, you know, he's still kind of searching at his age.
That's great, man, because I hope I'm like that, you know, when yeah. I'm like, I don't see any reason why you should just give up on things. I think that's probably what ends up putting people in the ground more than cancer, is like just giving up on like
passions
and like yeah. maybe, you know, your curiosity in things is mm-hmm. like probably the beginning of the end for everybody, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's funny to talk about Sabbath, because like the first Sabbath record I heard was Heaven and Hell.
Oh, wow.
My friend Ron, who's a few years older than me,
mm-hmm.
You know, he put me on to all kinds of like, or like Deep Purple, you know, Judas Priest, you know, the Dio era of Sabbath. Like, he played me Heaven and Hell, and I was like, wow, this is great, this is cool. You know, Richie Blackmore's Rainbow, and mm-hmm. I knew Dio sang in Rainbow for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, ah, this is great, man, it's a killer, you know, Neon Nights, and I was like, yeah, this is awesome. And then down the street from my grandmother's house, there was the Land of Our family, and this dude, Byron, was a good friend of mine, and, you know, I'd spent a lot of summer days like hanging out down there, and his sister's boyfriend, this guy Tom, you know, there's a whole other story with him, man, that I can get into another time, but he was living there for a while, and his record collection was moved in, and he had this banging stereo system, and he would play, you know, I was wearing like a Black Sabbath t-shirt, or he was wearing a Black Sabbath t-shirt, and I was like, yeah, man, I know Sabbath, you know, and
mm-hmm.
he was just like, oh, yeah, really? What do you know about Sabbath? I was like, you know, Heaven and Hell, man. He's like, that's the lightweight shit, man. And he's like, he played me, you know, We Sold Our Souls for Rock and Roll. And mm-hmm. I was like, the beginning of that record was Black Sabbath.
Yeah.
And I was terrified. I was like, I never knew music could sound that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, I never knew that was possible.
Yeah.
You know? And it completely upended my entire world. And I didn't even know if I liked it. I just knew that it had an impact on me. And I remember, because prior to that, I was a big Zeppelin fan, you know, and Zeppelin, you know, they fit within the idea of what music was,
yeah.
even though they were heavy and they were like, you know, rock and roll band. And,
yeah.
But they still fit within the acceptable framework of what melody sounds like.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? But then when you hear Black Sabbath, Iron Man, you know, Paranoid,
mm-hmm.
like, you're not even really sure if this is like, is this good? Mm-hmm. Should I like this? I'm a little afraid, you know? Like, I don't know what to make of any of this stuff. And that's what actually was the beginning for me embracing things that were to come years later. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. like when I, and then from there, probably the biggest milestone in my life was hearing Black Flag, because that was another experience, mm-hmm. you know? I think I saw the movie Repo Man. And I went out and I bought the Repo Man soundtrack, you know, back to soundtracks.
Yeah, right.
And Black Flag was on that. And I was like, I got to find out more about this band. You know what I mean? And then I went to the mall with some friends, and the only Black Flag record they had was Family Man. All right, so I bought that.
Right.
And I didn't know. I'm like, even though it says on the album cover, this is a spoken word record,
right,
something
right,
like that,
right.
Or, you know, there's some indicator as to what's actually on the record.
Right.
I listened to the first side of Rollins doing his poetry, and I was like, what? I'm like, you know, how am I supposed to feel about it? It's like
right.
salt on a slug, you know?
Right,
and I'm
right,
like,
right.
I didn't know how it made me feel. But then I heard the other side, which is the primarily instrumental. Yeah. And there's the one song, Armageddon Man.
Yeah.
And it barely sounded like music to me, man, yeah. at the time. And I was like, I don't know if I like this, man, but it's making me feel uncomfortable. And there's like something here that's like compelling. And I kept listening to it. And that was like the second phase two of music for me.
Right.
You know, and I think that feeling of, you know, I mean, also this is the 80s, you know what I mean? And like that kind of stuff isn't really, no one was into punk or anything. Like there are some metalheads, but they didn't really like punk, you know, most by and large.
Yeah. It was completely subdivided.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, there were like the Dirt Rollers in the smoking area in my high school who were like, you know, I could relate to them a little bit because, you know, they were in the Metallica and like Slayer.
Right.
But they didn't really know anything about Black Flag, except for one or two kids.
Yeah.
One or two kids are making that transition from metal and like
DRI
rock music.
Transition.
Yeah, and they were like, yeah, all right, the Ramones are cool, you know, like Suicidal, you know, Bad Brains. And then a couple of kids were like into like, I saw a kid with like Black Flag t-shirt, and I was like, all right, this is like, but there was only like maybe three kids who really knew what was going on with that stuff. And one of them was this kid, Mike Katz, who a couple years older than me, you know, he was this, you know, cool drummer guy. Like he was, you know, way ahead in everything. You know, he had a Ramones like back patch on his denim jacket or painting or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this guy knows what's up, man. He went to California one summer and then he came back. And I didn't really know him. I knew who he was because he was a couple years younger than me.
Right.
But we had mutual friends. And I remember he brought back with him the compilation Let Them Eat Jelly Beans, which had DOA, Black Flag, The Feeders, you know, all of those bands. I think the Circle Jerks might have been on that.
Right.
All those bands from that era.
Mm-hmm.
He came back to Carmel, New York, like my little, you know, bullshit little town.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the tapes started showing up, the dubs of that, you know what I mean? And then from there it was like, you know, Circle Jerks, you know, the Bad Brains. But Black Flag, I always felt, was like my own personal little discovery, man, because like no one really, they were into them, but like for me, and as time went on and, you know, you're growing into a young adult, a young man, you know, you're maturing from a child into a young man, and you're filled with all these emotions and these feelings, and you're coming into your own, and maybe you're feeling that like my trip isn't the same as like the dudes who are playing football and like getting drunk every weekend, and like fingering all the cheerleaders and whatever. And your thing's different, you know? And for me, I was spending a lot of time by myself, you know, like working out in the basement and like doing all this other stuff. You know, I was starting to get into playing guitar and like playing early, you know, in bands and whatnot. And like the Black Flag thing was like, you know, like sitting in your room alone, like checking this out, or sitting out down in the basement, like by yourself, like a tape player, just getting into it.
Right.
So yeah, Flag and like Sabbath, and that was the beginning of it all for me, man.
Yeah,
like, clearly.
There's one really important point that I definitely misspoke when I said that I came to Black Flag through Youth Crew. I definitely listened to Black Flag before that, and I forgot this really important thing. When I was younger, like this was, you know, skateboarding was becoming like the next cool thing, and like, I remember everyone had their Fishing Gator or like Pow Peralta boards or whatever. And I remember I just started skating, and I remember one of my friends who I would go skating with, his older brother was skating too, and he introduced me to first 4 years. And he introduced me to Join the Army.
Oh yeah, man.
Yeah.
Suicidal record.
Yeah. Yeah, and Agent Orange, and I remember one of the first ways that I got into Metallica was because they had that skateboard. They had that Zorlac skateboard. I was like, any band that's going to be cool enough to join on with a skateboard company is probably someone I should check out. And that's, you know, that's kind of the old school way of like how I discovered bands too, because I grew up in the suburbs too, and it was definitely a lot of research and, like, you know,
Yes.
Yeah.
I like that, though.
Yeah.
I miss that. I think that, like, you know, that level of searching that you had to do to find things, like, once you're pure, you know, you're... There was an ordeal. It was like, you know, you it didn't just come easy to you.
Yeah.
You know, and in general, things that come easy to you, I feel, aren't as appreciated. Mm-hmm. You know, and I miss the fact that, like, you have to really... You know, back then you had to search things out and know people and, mm-hmm. you know, interact with people to find out about other things. Now you can just go on your phone and, like, search anything.
Yeah. It's so funny. It's like, this is hilarious. But, you know, here I am, like, I'm a little kid. I run into my friend's older brother. He'd make one, like, little remark, you know, say, he'd make a passing Black Flag reference, you know. And that would be my obsession, you know?
Yes.
You know, it's just, he's an older guy, he's into cool stuff, and, you know, I probably idolized him at the time, sure. you know? And, but yeah, that's exactly how, I forgot about that point, because that's a really important point. It wasn't until later that I really started to dig into Black Flag.
Yeah.
But first 4 years, I think it's probably, you know, you aside, it's probably... everyone's first taste of Black Flag.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's like with, that's the pre-Rollins era, mm-hmm. you know, and that was kind of, yeah.
Simpler, and yeah.
more straightforward. Yeah, you know, yeah. It, you can hear, like, the Ramones influence on it.
Absolutely.
And I love all that stuff, man. You know, that stuff's great.
Yeah.
But for me, honestly, the more metal-oriented, maybe that really was what it was, because I was, like, way more of a metalhead coming into punk rock than a punk, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the sort of Sabbath-y, fast Black Sabbath, Greg Ginn guitar riffs and everything from mm-hmm. that era, and it was a more metal-sounding thing they were doing during that period, which is, like, what I guess they got criticized for by the punks, I guess.
Absolutely.
You know?
Did you ever see, I'm sure you've seen this, that interview with Henry Rollins, where the kid interviews him, he's like, "What do you guys think about being sellouts and all that?"
Oh yeah,
that's the greatest interview.
Totally,
so funny. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think is your definitive? Like, you're only allowed to listen to one Black Flag record. What record is that?
My War.
My War.
Yeah. Side two.
Yeah.
You know, like, some of the most gut-wrenching, emotional music ever made is on side two of My War, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yes, My War is definitely up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That record, I mean, that's just, like, you know, it just, for me personally, like, that record and, like, you know, in my head, mm-hmm. it's, like, got me through, like, so many parts, so many different, difficult periods in my life, and, you know, and even the Rollins Band, too. Like, the first few Rollins Band records were awesome. You know, they were, you know, like, Lifetime, Hard Volume, mm-hmm. especially those two, and specifically Hard Volume, mm-hmm. were, like, you know, it's just me and this fucking mattress and, like, a tape machine, you know, tape player. That's mm-hmm. what my life was like when I was experiencing those records, and it was...
Did you like the End of Silence record?
Yeah, it was great. I thought it was awesome. You know?
That was probably the first time I listened to Rollins, the Rollins Band. That was my entry into the Rollins Band.
Great record, you know. Yeah. I mean, that's probably, that version of the band probably at their peak was on that record. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as, like, you know, the playing, the production on that record, the songwriting was, like, on point, you know. And I mean, that's a standout record. I think that I'm surprised. I mean, Decibel would probably never write about that record as a Hall of Fame type of thing,
mm-hmm.
but it's in my Hall of Fame for sure. You know, it's more so than a fucking Pantera record, you know?
Yeah. The thing that I remember taking away from that record is the bass playing was just, it was just insane. Like, obviously some of the guitar riffs on there were completely different. It was heavy, but, like, oddly heavy, and that's why I was into it. It was almost like the bass was, like, super distorted and really bluesy, and then the guitar riffs were, like, jazzy and weird.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
But it still felt like a punk record, mm-hmm. you know, which is probably why I was so into it, because it was so fucking odd.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
But, and it also, like, I remember when that record was out, and that was, like, Lollapalooza and, you know, Rollins Band was, like, touring.
Like, Body Count.
Yeah, it was, like, yeah. They were doing, like, all these high-profile tours, you know? And I was thinking at the time, like, wow, maybe, like, they'll catch on, you know?
Yeah.
But it just didn't, you know what I mean? Like, in that way. In a way that, like, maybe Imago Records wanted it to, I think. Like, maybe it just didn't, like... There would be, I don't even know if it was on that touring cycle, but it would be like the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Rollins Band. It would be like Jane's Addiction and the Rollins Band.
Yeah, Susie and the Banshees. Or,
the Beastie Boys with Rollins opening, which makes sense on one level because, you know, the Beastie Boys are, you know, forward-thinking guys making really, you know, made really creative music.
Yeah.
You know, and Rollins, and they were friends, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the fan of the Beastie Boys, like, the Rollins Band trip was definitely too heavy for a fan of, like, the Beastie Boys.
Absolutely.
Was probably more concerned with, like, hanging out and partying, like, getting high and stuff like that.
But that's the thing. Who the hell would you put them with? At that time, there's probably no one you could put them with. Maybe Jane's Addiction?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Maybe.
You know, maybe, like, I don't know. Like, Helmet?
They did tour at Helmet, but years later, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, you know? It's like, what do you do with that? And it's kind of like, I guess that's the, you know, the reason why. Like mm-hmm. there's definitely, like, a limit to, like, what people would accept, I guess, you know? I feel like in the 70s, people were more open-minded to different styles. Like, if you were unique in the 70s, mm-hmm. people would pay attention to what you're doing, you know? I mean, think about the bands that were big in the 70s, you know, Thin Lizzy. Well, yeah, Thin Lizzy. I mean, they weren't massive, but they were a successful band.
Yeah.
You know, Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if Yes came out today, like, who would fucking listen to that?
No, I mean, no one would listen to that. I had a conversation about that with someone the other day. Yeah.
But Yes were massive.
Yeah.
You know? Pink Floyd. You know, yeah, great band. Mm-hmm. Probably still would be huge today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, you know, bands that, like, were unique and still were able to be commercially successful.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, because music and lifestyle are so interconnected, I feel that, like, people need, like, a nod from their friends, or they want to be unique, but they also want to fit within the mold of being unique.
Yeah, it's funny because I definitely had this conversation the other day. It's the what's that girl's name? That idiot girl who's in all those Apple commercials and I can see her smuggling.
She's a well-known actress or something.
Yeah, she's a well-known. She's got this show on Fox, and she's just this. I'm so cute and quirky little girl. And she's like, she's got this whole indie persona that is definitely baked in. I'm different from everyone, but you can tell it's a sales pitch, you know? And
well, yeah, I mean, everything these days feels like a sales pitch.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, but that's my point. It's getting back to that whole, you know, I'm different, but I'm comfortably different idea, you know? And that's definitely what it feels like, you know, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have TV, man. I mean, I have, like, this TV, but it's just like, I have Netflix. Like, I don't have, like, a cable connection or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I wish I did, though. I mean, it's, you know, there's definitely things I wouldn't mind watching, but in general, I feel sort of fortunate that I'm not exposed to that barrage of advertising that comes with television.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I have my favorite shows, man. Like, I love, you know, Breaking Bad and Walking Dead.
Best show on television.
You know, but I was watching on Netflix, man. Like, I don't think I've ever watched it in real time. Like,
are you caught up?
Not this newest season, because I don't know if that's available yet on DVD or Netflix.
Oh, my God. So good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good. Yeah, I mean, when it comes to TV, I watch, like, I can't live without The Daily Show. I think it's one of my favorite shows ever. And then
you know, I watch Breaking Bad, I watch like Mad Men, but like I end up, and this thing is, I work at home a lot.
Sure.
I end up like kind of putting like CNN or something and just having it on all day and just looking up at it periodically.
Yeah.
Because I like to feel connected. Even though CNN is, and this is the thing, is I'm not going to fool anyone. There's a lot of garbage on that shit, and they've got 24 hours to fill every single day. But yeah, you know, it's good to actually kind of, you know, I get some of my political news from there, and I obviously get it from 100 other different sources too, but sometimes I just keep it on there because I can't stand to, like, have silence in the room. So if I'm not listening to music, sometimes I'll put on CNN, just have it on.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. If I'm home working on stuff, I need to have, like, some sort of background noise, you know, going on. Yeah. Usually music or something like that. But, yeah, man, thanks for coming by. I think we're getting into the time where we got to get ready to go to our respective shows, man.
You know, absolutely.
I got to shower and, like, put on my special outfit for tonight and shine out my bullet belt. And, yeah.
That's a lot of individual bullet shining you got
to
do.
I know, dude. Try to put my makeup on and things like that. So. Yeah,
that's going to take a little while.
Yeah. I can't quite decide, like, which look to go with tonight, you know?
Yeah. What about like, Evil Troll? Why don't you do that one?
I don't know, man. That might be cool. I was thinking maybe Peter Chris or something.
Peter Chris, oh, yeah. That's a good idea. But yeah.
Bang, clean, with the bigger, yeah. They put me in a cell.